Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases and the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more. Straight talk. No nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
May 13th, 2015. Good morning, Talking Law fans. This is your host, Dan Hochheiser, criminal defense attorney in New York City, the Big Apple, Manhattan, broadcasting to you live from Lower Manhattan, just east of the Freedom Tower. We have a great show today. We will have Paige Kreuter, a former prosecutor in the Baltimore State's Attorney's Office. She will join us to talk about the prosecution of the six police officers arrested in the Freddie Gray homicide investigation. Before we get to Paige Kreuter, who I'm very excited to speak to this morning, we are going to talk about how you can follow the show. You can follow me on Twitter, at Dan Hochheiser, Hochheiser. You can like our Facebook page, please do. We always post the updates there. Facebook.com/talkinlaw. And please, if you have ideas for guests to be on the show, if you have ideas for how to improve the show, or you just want to send me your comments about the episode, please email me at talkinlaw, no G in talkin, talkinlaw@gmail.com, talkinlaw@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Without you, this show does not work. We need you. And I'm very appreciative that you listen to the show each and every week. It's my great pleasure to do the show. We try to entertain, educate, and include you in the conversation about the most important legal issues of the day. And today we're going to talk about that Baltimore Freddie Gray homicide prosecution of the police officers. But before we get to Paige Kreuter, we have the question of the day. Question: how many murders have been committed in New York City so far this year? How many murders have been committed in New York City so far this year? After we speak to Paige Kreuter about Baltimore, we will have the answer to that question. But before we get to Paige Kreuter, we are going to play two excerpts from the May 1st Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby's press conference announcing charges against the police officers. In total, it's about 1 minute of tape. Mark, please roll the tape.
Our ability to seek justice to the people of Baltimore and the demonstrators across America. I heard your call for no justice, no peace. Your peace is sincerely needed as I work to deliver justice on behalf of this young man. To those that are angry, hurt, or have their own experiences of injustice at the hands of police officers, I urge you to channel the energy peacefully as we prosecute this case. I have heard your calls for no justice, no peace. However, your peace is sincerely needed as I work to deliver justice on behalf of Freddie Gray. To the rank and file officers of the Baltimore City Police Department, please know that these accusations...
We have, I believe, some more tape. You're listening to Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser. We're going to roll a second clip.
Last but certainly not least, to the youth of this city, I will seek justice on your behalf. This is a moment. This is your moment. Let's ensure that we have peaceful and productive rallies that will develop structural and systemic changes for generations to come. You're at the forefront of this cause. And as young people, our time is now.
That was Baltimore State's attorney Marilyn Mosby on May 1st announcing charges against Officer Caesar Goodson, the driver of the police wagon where Freddie Gray incurred his injuries, which led to his death about a week later. Officer William Porter, Lieutenant Brian Rice, Officer Edward Nero, Officer Garrett Miller, and Sergeant Alicia White were all arrested with charges ranging from murder to false imprisonment. Our guest today knows this story about as well as anybody. Paige Kreuter spent nearly 21 years with the Baltimore State's Attorney's Office before retiring from that agency in January 2008. She began her legal career as an attorney for a legal aid program in rural Virginia and then spent 4 years as a commissioned officer and law specialist for the U.S. Coast Guard in New York City. After moving to Baltimore and becoming a city prosecutor, she served as a trial attorney, chief of the charging division, chief of personnel, and deputy state's attorney. Paige began blogging in 2008 to bring an insider's perspective to Baltimore's criminal justice system to illuminate for lay people some of the reasons why the system so often fails to function effectively. Paige Kreuter, are you with me?
I am here. Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Great. And for our listeners who have not read it yet, I urge everybody to go to Paige Kreuter, PageKreuter.blogspot.com and read Paige's blog entitled Baltimore's Hasty Prosecutor, which came out May 4th, which caused some controversy. Paige, let's get into this. Let's talk about this. First of all, who is Marilyn J. Mosby, the Baltimore State's attorney? What is her background?
Well, I'm not an expert in her background. I know she spent a few years in the prosecutor's office. She mostly was at the low level in the sense of she started at the low level, which most of us do, the misdemeanor cases. She did do handle some felony cases. She left before trying serious cases or getting any kind of supervisory experience, and then went into insurance law. And while being an insurance lawyer, decided to run for state's attorney. Her husband is a city councilman here in Baltimore, and she ran to become state's attorney, and she defeated the incumbent, Greg Bernstein, who had been in the office for 4 years.
So how long has Mosby been in office?
She's been in office. I think she took the oath at the beginning of January, so less than 5 months now.
Okay. And you've been, and I have been too. I was interviewed on the radio about this case by Gordon Deal recently, and I made some comments about what I thought of Marilyn Mosby's press conference announcing the charges. But I want to hear from you, Paige, what you think she did wrong in her handling of the investigation of the death of Freddie Gray.
Well, I don't know what you said, so your listeners are going to hear my comments that not influenced by what you said. Are you asking me about how she handled the charges or the press conference or both?
Whatever you want. You're the boss.
Okay. Well, the press conference, she clearly stepped over ethical boundaries when she had her press conference. A prosecutor's duty is to justice. It is not to the youth of America, protesters across the country, the youth of Baltimore City, to structural and systematic changes within the socioeconomic system here in Baltimore. The prosecutor's duty is to follow the evidence in a particular case and to act in accordance with that evidence. The press conference that she gave most people listening to it the impression that that was not what she was doing, that she was there to deliver justice for Freddie Gray and all who are protesting his death in police custody. That is definitely not her job. people have jumped to the assumption that because he suffered catastrophic injuries while in police custody, that the police department has committed a crime. That is an assumption. Her job is to follow the evidence to see what the proof is. And the police department, by the way, is not a criminal defendant. Each individual officer charged is a criminal defendant, and she has to find out what each of them did and did it rise to the level of a crime. She
now, Paige, before I know I asked you a compound question, and you were kind enough not to object, but I just before we get off this press conference, I want to discuss it a little bit deeper. I mean, that's basically brilliant minds think alike here, and I said some similar things publicly that you just said in terms of I was struck by her press conference in that it is obviously improper, and as a former prosecutor and somebody who's practiced for 18 years in criminal law, I was struck by her putting herself into the cause. This is our cause. I've heard your cry. This is your time. The time is now. You know, I will be working to seek justice on behalf of Freddie Gray, not the people of the city of Baltimore or the state of Maryland, but on behalf of Freddie Gray. So that struck me as that she was really going over the line and really off the rails in terms of forgetting what her job is, not to seek justice for Freddie Gray. She is the prosecutor for the people of the state of Maryland, as far as I understand. So, you know, I do agree with you on those points, but let's talk about what you would have done differently than Ms. Mosby did, because she brought these charges about 2 weeks after this terrible tragedy occurred.
I do want to mention something. Are you familiar with the video that has surfaced of her talking to a group of people while her investigation was going on and before she announced the charges? There is a video.
She went to an event. I saw she went to an event with her husband to a concert.
No, that was recent. That was after the charges. She went to a concert given here in Baltimore by Prince, and they invited her up on stage. And while she was up on stage, Prince was singing a song, you know, which mentioned Freddie Gray. And there's a controversy about that. But I was talking about a video that has come where she's talking to a group. This is while she's supposed to be investigating charges. And she's talking again about the protests, the riots. She takes a little political shot at the mayor here for using the word thugs with respect to the looters. So the whole context of the talk is political, and then goes on to say, we will pursue justice by any and all means possible. And again, that is suggestive that she's going to go after the cops, regardless of what the evidence is going to be. She's lent herself open to that interpretation. All right, so then when you see how she actually did this investigation, you know, that's what struck me first. I didn't hear her conference her conference live. I heard she announced the charges, and I was like, what, in 2 weeks? And then when I looked into what she did, It really is striking. She ignored all the normal tools that a prosecutor would use to investigate and come to a charging decision. She did not use the police department's investigators. Now, one may say, "Well, I don't trust the police." Blah blah blah. You still have to work with the police, see what they're doing. She could have easily and should have easily used her own homicide division. They do this all the time. Their whole job is to look into investigations and make charges in cases of suspicious deaths. If she was concerned about the police department, her homicide unit could have been right there riding herd on that investigation. But instead of using either her homicide division and the police department's investigation, and they had a task force, they had people out there on the streets doing, you know, tons of work, she ignored that. Instead, she conducted her own, what she called, parallel investigation, which I'm sure that you, as a defense attorney, would be licking your chops, because she has set up now two investigations in which there are bound to be inconsistencies.
I love it. Before we get to the inconsistencies, you're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking to Paige Kreuter, formerly of the Baltimore State's Attorney's Office. She was a prosecutor there for many years, and we're talking about the Freddie Gray homicide and the arrests of the six Baltimore police officers announced by Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby on May 1st. Paige, I apologize for cutting you off. And yes, as a defense attorney, I love having two sets of investigative materials to review. But one of the questions that jumped out at me, you're talking about tools that Mosby didn't use prior to making these arrests of the six police officers. How come she didn't use the grand jury?
Well, that would have been what would have happened, what she should have done, what, frankly, any prosecutor, her predecessors would have done, which anybody, any prosecutor with worth their salt would have done. She, the way it would have worked would be that the police department is investigating. She's got her homicide unit in charge of taking the evidence and bringing it before a grand jury. Now, this is not, there's a different, couple of different ways to use the grand jury. She's going to have to use it now, but it will be in a different context, and I'll get to that later. What she would have done here is she would have taken the witnesses, bring them before the grand jury, put them under oath, you know, lock them into their testimony. She would have brought all kinds of other evidence, tapes and so forth, in before the grand jury and explored it. And she would have had the opportunity to have the reaction of citizens, you know, a couple of dozen citizens in the grand jury who are going to give her feedback as to what they see from this evidence and what the appropriate charges would be. It would have been absolutely the way she should have gone, to be careful, to be thorough, and she didn't do it, and it's inexplicable. She had her own investigation. Again, she's using investigators from what she said was her police misconduct unit, of which there is one attorney assigned, and I don't know how many investigators. And then she uses deputies from the sheriff's department. The sheriff's department here in Baltimore does not investigate murder cases. They do security in the courthouse. They serve warrants. They don't investigate murder cases. So all along the way, everything she's doing is completely unorthodox, and she's speeding along. She did not. She had the police investigative report all of one day before she filed charges, and she did not even get
Paige,
an autopsy.
Paige. Yeah, yes, that's exactly where I want to go. I want to make sure we hit that. That is another thing that really jumped out at me as somebody who's tried homicide cases. I said to myself, really? She got the homicide report April 30th, and then she announces charges May 1st? She could not have had time to have a forensic pathologist look at the autopsy report and study it and give her an opinion about what it meant. Could she have?
Well, she said she got the autopsy report the very day she announced the charges. So, A...
Oh, the same day. Okay.
Yes. She didn't even... She had the police report the day before, which she could not have had any time to digest. She couldn't have compared it to her... Had time to digest it, compare it to her own investigation, explored questions that she had with the police department. And then the autopsy report she gets the day that she announced charges. She threw in at the end of her probable cause statement, you know, that the examiner said it was a homicide case. Well, that's a conclusion. You would have to discuss with the medical examiner why, what led him to that conclusion. I have to do all kinds. You'd have to look at the toxicology, which usually doesn't come at the same time as the autopsy report. All kinds of questions and issues need to be reviewed and discussed. Didn't have time to do any of that. Clearly, the police report and the autopsy report were not essential to what she intended to do. And all of that is
now,
borne
Paige,
out.
Paige, I just want to back up because our time is limited. I want to make sure we hit certain issues that are important. I want to talk about the knife, if you don't mind. There's a big issue, as I understand it, about whether the knife recovered from Freddie Gray at the time of his arrest was a legal folding knife or an illegal spring-loaded switchblade. What is your opinion about whether the police had probable cause to arrest him?
Well, I found those two charges, those charges against the two arresting officers, the most remarkable of what she did. It was like she was determined to sweep up everybody who touched Freddie Gray that day. And by going after these two arresting officers, and I'll get to your question and knife in a moment, but she has set a very chilling precedent for the police department, which is that she noticed that she doesn't charge them with lying, with planting evidence. She charges them with false imprisonment and illegal arrest, meaning that if they had made a mistake in good faith about whether they had probable cause, and you and I know probable cause can be in the eye of the beholder. So if they make a mistake, they could be criminally charged. She could not possibly have thought out the implications of that in her 2 weeks. I think she was just so determined. I mean, that's how it appears, to have just swept up every officer who touched him that day. But the knife is an interesting question because, again, it shows her haste. The police task force says that the knife was spring-assisted. That makes it illegal under the Baltimore City Code. She's saying it's not illegal. Just the fact that there's a dispute would show that the officers had good faith in believing that the knife was illegal. And then I hear that people are saying, well, maybe if the knife is legal, they didn't have the right to chase him. Well, there is certainly...
You mean illegal, Paige.
Excuse me, yes. Even if the knife is illegal and a violation of Baltimore City Code, they didn't have probable cause because they shouldn't have chased him in the first place. Well, she really doesn't make an issue of that in a probable cause statement. She seems to make an issue of the knife being legal, but even so, it was charged by a judicial officer, and there's plenty of case law supporting, again, the good faith of the officers. If she had taken any time whatsoever to think about this, to talk to the police about why they thought the knife was legal, to realize that a court commissioner here in Baltimore City had charged this case as having probable cause. He just described the knife. He said it's spring-assisted. And a judicial officer here in Baltimore charged Freddie Gray with having an illegal knife. So,
now, Paige, let me just jump in. In terms of the knife, in terms of the probable cause analysis, I am also bothered by what I know, and I think I have incomplete facts, but maybe you have more facts than I do. It seems to me that the people who say, well, even if the knife on Freddie Gray in his waistband is illegal, the police didn't know he had a knife. So, yeah, they had no reason to chase him. And then the fact that they recover the knife after the fact, that doesn't give them probable cause. That's not how probable cause works. That would be suppressed, and the case would be thrown out. You can't arrest people who aren't committing crimes and then find something illegal on them and then use that to say, well, that supplies the probable cause. The law doesn't work like that. I mean, what's your view on that argument?
Well, we don't know what happened when. The way the police officer wrote the report was that they detained Freddie Gray and noticed that he had a knife. And you and I know the devil's in the details, how they noticed that he had the knife. But he ran unprovoked in a high-crime area, and there is law supporting, you know, that may provide reasonable suspicion to stop and detain. But what I'm trying to say is this, is that they normally, if an officer who has acted in good faith, hasn't planted evidence, hasn't lied, if they've made a mistake as to their reason to chase or the reason to arrest, the remedy is that the charges are thrown out. It is not that an officer is criminally charged. You could not have a police department if that is the remedy. Because they're out there making split-second decisions and, on issues that are, when people write law review articles. So I can't believe, and she hasn't charged those two officers with having anything to do with the death of Freddie Gray. So she has really rushed into a decision on charging those two officers, and I think very improperly so.
Paige, we have about a minute left together, and I really appreciate you taking the time this morning. I want to talk about conflicts, potential conflicts of interest that the prosecutor in Baltimore, Marilyn Mosby, may be suffering from. It seems to me there are three potential conflicts that I'm aware about, and I want to get your thoughts. Number one, her husband's a city councilman who appears to have a horse in this race. Number two, Freddie Gray's family lawyer, Bill Murphy, was a campaign contributor and is expected to sue the city of Baltimore for damages on Freddie Gray's family's behalf. And number three, she has inserted herself into the cause of the protesters when she made her statements at the press conference.
Yep, I agree with you on all three points. And Billy, and I don't think her husband being councilman in and of itself would do it. Her relationship with Billy Murphy is particularly troubling because not only was he a campaign contributor, he was a member of her transition team. And there was an article in the local Daily Record here that the day she was sworn into office, she dismissed a case against an individual who was represented by Billy Murphy's firm. An officer and another officer were charged with animal cruelty in the course of their duties. And it was pending. The case was pending. There was no motion set, you know, for arguing that particular day. And that particular day, the day she's sworn in, one of the co-defendants, the one represented by Billy Murphy's office, the case was dismissed. Now, the article yesterday indicated that now the other co-defendant is asking for her to recuse herself because they see in that action her influenced by Billy Murphy. So she's really sort of getting herself into it there. But I think that when you add her press conference into it, the fact that she clearly stepped over a prosecutor's ethical boundaries and what their duties are, which is to the truth, not to causes, not to protesters, not to youth, not to anybody but justice, she has definitely provided grounds for a judge to have her her office recused. And, you know, I have to say that that would be kind of ironic because if the cases were then to go away because of her haste, because of her lack of care in preparing the charges and preparing the evidence or in setting up, you know, discrepancies between investigations, she gets to say, I tried, whereas the mess may have been of her own making.
Paige Kreuter, thank you so much. We're out of time. I appreciate you joining us. I hope you'll come back and speak with us later on when this case develops a bit more. I urge all our listeners to go to Paige Kreuter, PageKreuder.blogspot.com, and read Paige's excellent blog entitled Baltimore's Hasty Prosecutor. Check it out. Paige, thanks again, and take care.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Now, before we get to Beth Karras of KarrasOnCrime.com, who is going to speak to us about Eitan Patz and James Holmes, we are going to answer the question of the day. Question, how many murders have been committed in New York City so far this year? Answer, according to DNAinfo.com, citing NYPD statistics, so far this year, New York City has had 109 murders. This is an increase of 10 murders from the same period last year. Murders, according to NYPD statistics, have been decreasing every year since 2010. In 2014, New York City's murders totaled 333. So it appears to continue this downward murder trend in New York City. For the past 5 years, New York City would need fewer than 224 murders for the rest of this year. If there are more than 224 murders for the rest of this year in New York City, we would have the first increase in murders since the 2009 increase from 471 murders to the larger 2010 total of 536 murders. Come on, New York, we can do it. Stop killing each other. Now, give me Beth Karras. Give me a kiss.
Beth, what can I do?
Talkin' Law Radio brings you a live Karras on Crime special report from Beth Karras, former prosecutor, Court TV, HLN television correspondent, and founder of KarrasOnCrime.com. Now here's Beth with the latest legal news.
Beth, what can I do?
morning, Beth.
Good morning, Dan.
How are you? Did you get to hear any of Paige Kreuter?
Only the tail end of it, but I want to go back and read that. I tried to write down the her email or her website address really fast, but I'll have to get it from you again later.
I'll give it to you again now. PaigeKreuter.blogspot.com. Yeah, it's a must-read. So anyway, let's talk about Eitan Patz, the little boy who was kidnapped and killed in 1979 and gained notoriety by being one of the first children put on a milk carton. The jury in that trial was declared hung. A mistrial was declared just a couple of days ago. What happened there, Beth?
Yes, the last time we spoke, they were still deadlocked, right, a week ago. Last Friday, when the judge declared the mistrial following the third deadlock note, in a surprise, we learned the actual vote. It was 11 jurors to convict, and there was one lone holdout. But even more surprising was the fact that many of them, not all, but many of them stood before and sat before the cameras shortly afterwards, and the holdout was among them. It's so different from the experience I had at the Jody Arias case, where everybody wanted to basically lynch the one holdout who didn't want to give Jody Arias death and would never have appeared with her. Well, these jurors all respected each other, and it turns out that their votes in the course of the 18 days they were deliberating started out as 8 to convict and 4 to acquit. Then it went down to 6 to 6. Then it went up to 9-3, then 10-2, then 11-1. It wasn't 11 to convict and 1 to acquit until the day of the deadlock. That one holdout was never going to change his mind. I've read that he said, I'll keep you guys here for 3 months. I'm not changing my mind. Although everybody respected each other, there wasn't a lot of vitriol among them at all. And this one holdout, who's been vocal, been interviewed, said he just couldn't get past the mental health issues going on with the defendant, Pedro Hernandez, who's now 54. He was 18 at the time. And, he confessed several times. But according to this juror, he found subsequent confessions to get more and more bizarre. There would be little details that changed. He indeed is sort of borderline mentally retarded. I know that's a politically incorrect term today, but he has about a 70 IQ, and his attorney, Pedro Hernandez's attorney, told me the IQ was 70, been diagnosed with schizophrenia. So false confessions were a concern to this juror, and they should be a concern to everyone when a person who's mentally ill confesses. But I take issue with the scenario where a lot of false confessions are elicited, and in this case, when false confessions have been arguably elicited, it's because the police zeroed in on a suspect and were talking to them and may have planted the idea of certain facts and the person confesses. That's not what happened here. He's confessing to people who were not trying to elicit anything out of him. The police were not involved at all. It's a very different scenario. And
you're talking about the confessions prior to the police questioning, which I believe started in 2012 when a family member alerted the police that he had admitted to this terrible murder?
Yes. I'm sorry. Yes, of course, he did speak to the police. But he, several times over the years, and I don't have the chronology, but he started like in 1979 when this happened. He told a prayer group. He told an ex-wife. He told people he heard a little boy. I mean, he brought the police to the area and told them. I lured him. I bribed him basically with a soda, got him into the bodega where I was working, and then in the basement I strangled him. I put him in a bag. I put him out here on the street in the bags. I mean, he's pointing this stuff out. It was very convincing not all jurors initially. Granted, a couple were caving in the last few days, and one even, voted guilty, changed his vote the day of the deadlock. But the one holdout was never going to change. Anyway,
I couldn't believe that this guy held out, and it takes such a strong person to do that when there are 11 people in a room all saying guilty, and you're the only one who thinks the case is not proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and you hold out. It takes a special kind of person. And what struck me is I really thought it was pretty persuasive that this lone holdout spoke about this other scenario, which was presented very effectively by defense attorney Harvey Fishbein, that Jose Ramos, this convicted pedophile who had been found civilly liable for the death of Eitan Patz, he could have done it. Why isn't that reasonable doubt?
Well, I don't, you know, because I did not see every detail at the, you know, I didn't see the trial, so, and it wasn't televised, so I can't tell you exactly why, but it's a different standard at a civil case. They just had to show preponderance of the evidence, and Ramos has always maintained that he did not kill this little boy. Now, okay, and he was convicted of trying to lure some boys, you know, apparently had similar looks to Eitan Patz, you know, this is in the 1980s, in the Bronx. You know, so, you know, there might have been enough or more likely than not, but not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, is he the killer? I don't know. It seems like what Hernandez was offering was a lot more detailed than what Ramos was, and Ramos, I mean, they never could have prosecuted him on what they had with Ramos, right? Proof beyond a reasonable doubt, it's a tough burden. And I might add that there are a couple of states, Oregon and Louisiana, who have non-unanimous verdicts for certain crimes, murder and rape. It can be 11 to 1 or 10 to 2, and there's a reason. There's a lot of resources spent and time spent. I mean, 11 people were convinced he was guilty. You know, I just put it out there that shouldn't that stand? Isn't that good enough? And in some
no,
case,
it's not that I have to take issue, Beth. It's not good enough for me. We have a system. The founding fathers crafted the Constitution specifically because they were afraid of the government and they wanted to put the citizenry, the jury, between us and the prosecutors, and they wanted to make sure that, you know, a unanimous group of people could agree that we were guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard, beyond a reasonable doubt. And I don't know. I also did not see the trial, but what I've read about it, I don't see how those 11 people could get to beyond a reasonable doubt, given that Ramos pedophile situation. That's an alternative scenario. I don't know how you can rule that out to say there's no reasonable doubt.
Well, the DA,
you might think he did it, but
the DA stood up last Friday and said, Your Honor, we want another date. They have June 10th as a control date, status conference, to see about the retrial. I mean, it's my understanding there's going to be a retrial, but she stood up and asked for a date.
Oh, and I bet. And right. In your opinion, Beth, who does the retrial favor, in your opinion, in this case? You think it favors the prosecution, the defense? Does it make any difference?
You have such a close call like this, 11 to 1. Yeah, it favors the prosecution. In my experience at Court TV, covering trials around the country, some were retrials. Almost all retrials end up in convictions. I can't even tell you what. Well, there's one retrial that was another hung jury, and the jury is deliberating now in the third trial, right now in Los Angeles. But they favor the prosecution, definitely.
I think you're right, and I think one of the reasons they do favor the prosecution is because the prosecution gets to look at the transcript of the first trial, they get to polish up their case, they get to fix any mistakes they may have made, perhaps streamline their presentation of evidence, and they already know the defense, you know,
right,
intricately. So I think you are right. I agree with you that the retrials generally favor the prosecution. Unless there's something else on that issue, do you want to talk about what's going on in the Colorado Theater shooting trial?
Sure. I'm following it pretty closely because I do this show online, which is aired in Denver at night at 7:30 on TalkCenterAmerica.tv, and do a little synopsis and some legal analysis. So 85 witnesses have testified in 11 days of testimony. That, I mean, 10 days of testimony, 11 days of trial, because the first day was openings only. That's a lot of witnesses. And the state peppers in, as they did last week, and they continues to do, a couple of survivors of the shooting amidst all of the police testimony, because there's a lot of crime scene stuff, and, you know, there's photos and the bullets and all the guns, and, you know, he had rigged his apartment to blow up if you know, anyone walked into it. He had a fishing line and all this. It was a very intricate little design he had that took him hours and hours to set up so that his apartment would blow up. But they were able to basically defuse it. And the jury heard details about that. They've been hearing about how James Holmes was planning this, apparently, from May, the previous May. This happened July 20th, 2012, where 12 people were murdered in the theater, 70 were injured. And so a lot of victims still to testify. And all of my understanding is all the injured victims will testify, and we've heard from about 25, 28 right now, and not all were injured. Some were just eyewitnesses to the shooting. But they have been hearing.
But Beth, wasn't there a defense objection to introduction of some graphic crime scene evidence?
Well, they argued a couple of days ago that they didn't think the fingerprint expert needed to go through details about how they removed the 10 bodies that were in the theater. Two more died outside. The 10 bodies left in the theater for hours. As you know, they don't remove bodies until all the photos are taken and stuff. And had to fingerprint the deceased. And she's like, you know, and to identify them. And one of the defense lawyers, and they're very good lawyering on both sides, one of the attorneys had argued that, you know, their identities are not an issue. The identities have already been established by friends who were with them on the stand or IDing them from photographs. I mean, so why do we need to hear this really graphic, disturbing testimony about how the deceased were carried into the lobby and they were fingerprinted for identity? And so actually one fingerprint expert did testify yesterday, and the, it was very, very short testimony. So they did prevail, and that the judge is being pretty fair here. He's not letting gratuitous stuff in anymore. I mean, they've established the chaos outside the theater, the chaos inside. So when more and more law enforcement people get on the stand, they're not able to set the scene again because the scene has been set plenty of times. They jump right to what their contribution was, what evidence they collected or what they did.
So what's going to happen for the rest of this week in the Colorado Theater shooting trial?
Well, they're not showing their hands. So, and there's no witness list that's available. So all I can say is that this week and next week, Friday is dark. The judge is going to be taking every other Friday roughly off, although there's two in a row this week because of Memorial Day in 2 weeks. And but otherwise, it's a five-day week, and he really pushes it. These are full days. But I can just tell you that every day, somebody who was a civilian inside that theater will take the stand, because that breaks up what is important but can be monotonous testimony from crime scene investigators.
Beth, what's new on KarisOnCrime.com? Tell us what's up and how people can subscribe to that excellent site.
Well, my site is really following Holmes very closely right now, and I'm about to launch a new look. It's the same content, but a new look. So I have all kinds of stuff, not archived yet, still available, and still getting new stuff on Jodi Arias, because a lot of people are still interested in the aftermath of Jodi Arias. So it's Jodi Arias and James Holmes in detail, but I'm collecting court documents on Robert Durst, on Justin Ross Harris. He's the father accused of murder for leaving his baby in a hot car outside of Atlanta, and so my members are interested in that. So I continue to follow, you know, cases around the country and offer my own analysis, and I do a little video at night where I kind of chat with my members, who I feel are kind of all friends. We got a little club going, and I answer their questions and teach them about the law as well.
That's great. And Beth, before I let you go, you talked about you're on this new, I believe, streaming television.
Yes, it's
fine with Diane Diamond. How can people find
Diane
that?
Diane Diamond. It's called Crime Time Live, and it's on TalkCenterAmerica.tv. And it's this new technology where Diane Diamond is hosting, and she's basically doing it all. I mean, she just operates it all like a control room. It's here outside of the city in New York, and I Skype in from my apartment. And the difference is, it's a video call center, is that instead of callers calling in on the phone and being interviewed, they Skype in. So people are actually on TV. And this is...
We have everybody
forever.
Check out Beth on that Cutting Edge TV show. Beth, thanks so much. We'll talk to you next week.
My pleasure.
You have been listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. That is our show for today. Next Wednesday, 9:30 a.m., we will have another edition of Talkin' Law Radio for you with another great guest. Check out our Facebook page to find out who we will have next week, facebook.com/talkinlaw. Follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, Hochheiser. Send me an email, talkinlaw@gmail.com. I wish everybody peace and justice. Take care.